reason, every attempt turned out a failure. Either the loaves failed to rise, or else they puffed up absurdly and turned hard as bricks. Even worse, while in the oven, none of these loaves gave off that delicious baking bread smell that makes the streets of Paris so appealing, as there is a boulangerie on nearly every street in that fair French city. Au contraire, these loaves smelled horrible. One gave off the stink of smelly toe shoes the minute it was put in the oven. Another smelled like a pile of wet rope encrusted with seaweed and left to rot in the sun. And a nasty, fishy aroma it was. Even a promising-smelling sourdough soon turned rank. The longer it baked, the more it smelled like a wet dog that had recently encountered an angry skunk, and the terrible odor lingered for days afterward. It was uncanny, to say the least. If one were inclined to believe in the supernatural, one might even suspect that the bakehouse at Ashton Place had fallen under some sort of a curse. Now, Mrs. Clark did tend to believe in the supernatural within reason, but she was no quitter. Two, she had long been in the habit of having a piece of buttered toast and marmalade at 11 o'clock in the morning, and was sad to miss it. Curse or no curse, a baker was needed, and a baker must be found, even if the whole of England had to be searched. The housekeeper thought hard about who to send on this difficult quest. It would have to be someone quick and close-lipped. For once rumours of those foul-smelling, inedible loaves spread, no respectable baker would dare come to Ashton Place for fear of the dreaded bakehouse curse. Imagine if such a thing were contagious. That could be the end of bread everywhere for everyone. Bread declared extinct, bakehouse curse to blame, the headlines would read.
Quick and close-lipped. I'd say old Timothy's the man for the job, she decided.
The enigmatic fellow was well aware of the estate's predicament, as he himself was a skilled sandwich maker, and the lack of bread had deprived him of his favourite lunchtime meal. Mrs. Clark gave him strict orders not to return to Ashton Place until he had found a truly excellent baker. By now there were tummies rumbling from one end of the vast estate to the other, and the villagers would not settle for less. He chose a pair of his fastest horses and a small, swift carriage.
"There's only so much soup and boiled potatoes a man can stand at luncheon. I'll find your baker, missus," he declared, "even if I have to go to the edge of the earth or beyond. Hey-yar!"
he called to his team, and off he went. 3 days later, he returned, the horses lathered and winded as if they had run the Derby. The coachman said not a word as he walked them around the drive to cool them off. Mrs. Clark chased after him.
"But who's the baker? Where's the baker?"
she demanded to know, for the villagers were now 3 days grumpier than they had been before.
"In the bakehouse. Where do you think?" he replied crossly.
"What's the baker doing there?"
"Baking, maybe," he retorted. "What else would a baker be doing in a bakehouse? Now, out of my way, I've business of my own to attend to. This way now, my lovelies. What a good run you had."
He made soft cluck-cluck noises to the horses, turned them gently, and headed for the barn. Mrs. Clark fretted and paced, but within the hour a thin plume of smoke rose from the bakehouse chimney. Before long, the delirious, unmistakable smell of baking bread was carried on the early spring breeze. Drooling mobs formed as the bread-starved villagers caught the scent. When the tempting aroma reached the open windows of the nursery, it brought Master Gogolev to a near breakdown.
"Bread, bread, bread! I am losing my mind. All I can smell is bread. Ah, why did it have to be a baker?"
He babbled in a mix of languages and pounded his fists on the nursery wall until the plaster threatened to crack. Alarmed, the incorrigible children persuaded him to sit down. They tucked him in a chair with a blanket round his legs and brought him cups of tea and some paper and a pen, so that he might express his feelings by writing bad poetry rather than by breaking things. But they too had been captivated by the tantalizing smell. They quickly added "eat bread" to their to-do-a-woo list and ran downstairs to the kitchen.
"We volunteer to be bread tasters,"
Beowulf announced.
"Bread tasters! Woof!"
Alexander interjected as a reminder that they were supposed to act woofy again.
"Yes, woof! I mean, off!"
Beowulf stepped forward to explain.
"We are the bread-eating and sweet treats, grrr!"
Cassiopeia added, in case there was any cake involved.
"Grrr, yes! Incorrigible Evaluation Squad. Yap, yap."
"Well, you're just in time, loves. I mean, beasties,"
Mrs. Clark said after she had puzzled out the acronym and had a good chuckle.
"The first basket of samples has arrived from the bakehouse this minute. What's the verdict? Do we have a baker or do we not?"
She opened the basket and the irresistible smell floated up doubly strong. There they were, still warm from the oven, dozens of flat, round cakes in a fragrant heap, nestled in a colourful, wildly patterned cloth.
"Gypsy cakes!"
Alexander exclaimed, wide-eyed. He was so surprised he almost forgot to say, "Awoo!" Beowulf grabbed a loaf in each fist. "Umph!" he said, jamming them into his mouth. "Umph! Umph! Umph!" Cassiopeia wriggled with excitement, for there was only one person this side of the veil who baked in this particular kind of way.
"That means the new baker must be the semi-soufflous truthsayer. The semi-soufflous truthsayer."
It was not easy to speak clearly with a mouth full of gypsy cake.
"I mean, it must be Madame Ionesco."
"Oh, you must have another,"
Alexander interrupted, tucking a piece of his own loaf into his sister's mouth.
"The beasties approve of this baker," he said to Mrs. Clark in an official tone. "Let the bread baking commence. Grrr! Woof!"
agreed Beowulf.
"Yap, yap!"
Cassiopeia said, making it unanimous.
"Judging from the mouth-watering smell, I agree with your decision, beasties. But it couldn't hurt for me to take a bite now, could it?"
Mrs. Clark helped herself to one of the little round loaves and nearly swooned.
"Oh, now, this is some of the nicest bread I've ever had. But you three are surely in a puppyish mood today. I haven't heard this much yapping and a-wooing in many a month."
She patted them on their heads and gave each of them a gypsy cake to take with them, plus one extra for nuts-a-woo.
"It's to be expected, I suppose. Poor Miss Lumley's been gone too long. No harm in it, though, is there? I ought to try a bit of barking myself."
Full of wonder, the incorrigibles raced back to the nursery. Master Gogolev sat scribbling his poems and sobbing in a corner, where he could safely be ignored. The children gathered in the back nursery, the small separate room where their beds were, as it was a place where they could close the door and speak in private. They arranged themselves in a circle, squatting on their haunches as they used to do. Alexander had some trouble, as his legs had grown so long. How quickly he had become used to sitting in chairs! They opened the folded napkins Mrs. Clark had wrapped their tasty treasures in and put all four cakes in the middle of the circle for closer examination. With eyes closed, they inhaled deeply, for a good, concentrated sniff was the most foolproof way of knowing what was what. In this case, there was no doubt.
"These," Alexander said, "are gypsy cakes. 100% gypsy cakes,"
Beowulf concurred.
"Mmph, mmph,"
said Cassiopeia, by which she meant,
"Yum, yum."
She was already eating hers, for it was too good to resist. When she was done swallowing, she added,
"But why would Madame Ionesco pretend to be a baker?"
"That is the question,"
Beowulf agreed, Hamlet-like. All three grew silent and thoughtful.
She could be travelling incognito, Alexander suggested.
His siblings had studied enough Latin to know what incognito meant. It was simply in, which means not, plus cognitus, which means to know. Thus, to travel incognito means to be not known, to use a false identity, or to be in disguise. Interestingly, the word incorrigible is also made from bits of Latin, in plus corrigible, which means able to be fixed. Whether the incorrigible children were fixable or not would depend on whom you asked. Miss Penelope Lumley would say yes, of course they were. Like all children, they simply needed patient instruction on how to behave properly. Lady Constance Ashton might say the opposite. They were incorrigible, hopelessly wild and scarcely human, and could never learn to be otherwise. The children never troubled themselves about whether they were fixable or not, as they did not consider themselves broken in the first place. You may decide for yourself what to think about it, but it is worth remembering that often people who are told they need fixing are perfectly fine as they are. It is our own narrow notion of how things ought to be that is truly in need of repair. As Agatha Swanburn once observed, narrow minds are like narrow roads. Only one idea at a time can pass, and that makes for slow going indeed. Alexander's incognito theory made sense, for Madame Ionesco was well known to Lady Constance and Lord Frederick. In fact, she had visited the estate some months earlier to conduct a séance that did not go precisely as planned.
"You can't bottle round the dead,"
as a soothsayer tried to explain afterward, but Lady Constance was convinced the fortune-teller was a fraud and spoke harshly about the incident for weeks afterward. Because of this unfortunate misunderstanding, the spooky madame might not be a welcome visitor at Ashton Place, which gave her good reason to travel in disguise. But why would old Timothy bring the semi-toothless soothsayer back to the house to begin with?
"If we ask old Timothy to explain, he will do this,"
Beowulf grunted enigmatically and walked away in a fine imitation of old Timothy's rolling, bow-legged gait.
"Maybe a crystal ball could tell us,"
Cassiopeia said. All three children remembered how the fortune-teller had used a crystal ball to summon spirits from beyond the veil. It seemed to be a handy and informative item. The problem was they had no crystal ball. Theirs was a well-stocked nursery indeed, thanks to their former governess. But a crystal ball was not an everyday classroom item, even in Miss Lumley's day.
"Or crystal globe,"
she went on, thinking of the items they did have.
"Crystal abacus? Crystal... A Child's History of England by Mr. Charles Dickens?"
It was Alexander, growling deep in the back of his throat the way he used to, long ago in the forest, when he was thinking hard and wanted quiet. It had been a long time since Beowulf and Cassiopeia had heard him make this sound. Frankly, it was rather exciting.
"In the words of Agatha Swanwell,"
Alexander said when he had their attention,
"let's go to the bakehouse and find out."
The sixth chapter. Travelling incognito has its advantages. When Alexander Incorrigible quoted Agatha Swanawoo as saying,
"Let's go to the bakehouse and find out,"
he was using a form of poetic license called paraphrasing. In other words, he used other words than the ones she used, but the meaning of his words and the meaning of her words were essentially the same, and that is what it means to paraphrase, using different words to say more or less the same thing. Those of you who pay close attention already know the wise founder's exact words, which appear earlier in this very tale. As for the rest of you, peek if you must. But be quick about it, for the incorrigibles are eager to get to the bakehouse and discover if their theory about the incognito soothsayer holds water or not, as the saying goes. Paraphrasing is a useful time-saver, as it is not always convenient to stop and look up a quotation when making a point, especially if the situation is urgent, as this one surely was. However, any lawyer, judge, or professional thespian will tell you that there are times when knowing the exact words is essential. For example, when performing the role of Hamlet, or when given the task of ending a wolfish family curse. As Madame Ionesco herself once said,
"A curse is like a contract. It's all in the wording."
That is no paraphrase. Those were her exact words, and it was the exact words of the curse upon the Ashtons that the fortune-teller had to know in order to undo it, or attempt to, at least. Through pluck, luck, and a knack for the theatrical, Penelope and Simon had managed to discover those exact words shortly before Penelope was whisked away to Plinkst. Even as they bade each other a heartbroken farewell on that cold January day in Brighton, Simon swore he would return to London, find the soothsayer, and tell her what the two friends, and surely they were more than just friends, had found out. Had Simon succeeded in his mission? If so, had the soothsayer solved the puzzle of how the cursed Ashtons could be uncursed once and for all? Was that why she had returned to Ashton Place, travelling incognito as a baker? These are all fine questions, and you may well ask them, but the incorrigible children did not, for they did not know nearly as much as you do about the Ashton curse. All that they know, they had learned from eavesdropping on adult conversations, like most children who have had that experience, and what child has not? They understood only some of what they overheard, and they felt no obligation to remember it all or even make sense of it, for it was not their concern to begin with. No, they were much more interested in the gypsy cakes. Visit the bakehouse was hastily added to the to-do-a-woo list. If the new baker was indeed Madame Ionesco, it would explain all those dreadful, bad-smelling loaves, for the spooky Madame was not above bending the rules to suit her own purposes. She always charged double to the swankily dressed. At solitaire, she cheated like mad. To put a temporary spell on a bakehouse would be well within her capacity for mischief. Excited, the children ran to get their coats. If they were lucky, they might arrive in time for the beasties to sample the next batch of those delicious-smelling, yummy-tasting, perfectly scrumptious loaves of
bread.
Master Gogolev staggered into the back nursery, bellowing like a giant from a fairy tale.
"I smell bread. Where are you hiding it?"
Then his bluster left him, and he leaned heavily against the wall, too weak to stand.
"Bread! Oh, bread! Oh, wonderful, terrible bread! If there were but a single crust left in all the world, I would starve rather than eat it. Slowly I would pass from this world to the next, while inhaling its delicate aroma, and spend my last breath dreaming of less miserable times."
By now, three of the four gypsy cakes Mrs. Clark had given them were in the children's tummies. Cassiopeia had the last in her coat pocket, in case they spotted Nutsawoo on the way to the bakehouse. The little scamp was still being elusive, but she, or he, never refused a treat and would eagerly perform tricks to get one. Juggling one acorn, for example, or flicking that bushy tail in time to the Swanburn school song, like a furry grey metronome. Master Gogolev sighed and sighed again. He seemed desperate. But for what? The children exchanged looks.
"If there were bread," Alexander ventured, "we would happily give you some, arf."
Gogolev clenched his fists and tugged at his collar, groaning.
unless you would prefer that there was no bread,
Beowulf added.
In which case, we would make sure there was none. Yap, yap.
To bread or not to bread?
Cassiopeia said magnificently.
That is the question. Woof!
Yes, bread or no bread. Bread, no bread.
Gogolev sniffed again.
But there is bread here. I feel it in my bones.
He came toward the children, who shrank back until the foolish man dropped to his knees.
If you have some, yes, give it to me. I beg you. Writing even a few lines of melancholy poetry has drained every drop of strength from me. Perhaps a nice, thick slice of pumpernickel with a smear of caviar would restore my will to live.
Reluctantly, for she would have much preferred to share it with Nutsuwu, Cassiopeia gave him the one gypsy cake they had left. He brightened at once, slipped the round loaf into his pocket, and made a beeline for the kitchen.
It would take a miracle to find decent caviar in this primitive land,
he remarked on his way out.
But a plate of smoked herring would do nicely in a pinch.
The children waited to make sure he did not come back.
Now, said Alexander, once more unto the bakehouse. Up, up, up. Wait.
Beowulf held up a hand, for this strange interlude with Gogolev had given him time to think.
If the new baker is Madame Gypsy Cake, something spooky must be going on. Spooky and secret. Maybe we should be incognito too.
The other two saw his point, for who does not like to sneak about in disguise? The incognito incorrigibles they would be. But what sort of disguise would be best? It would have to be something that came in threes, obviously, and that would allow them to keep acting like little wolf pups, for they had promised Lord Frederick, and a promise was a promise.
Three little pigs, Alexander suggested.
Beowulf thought it over.
We would have to oink, he said, but wolfishly.
They tried, but
oinkeroo
failed to convince as either a pig noise or a howl. Anyway, Cassiopeia pointed out,
no one will believe we are pigs.
She gestured to show what she meant. Two legs instead of four, pert noses, a telltale lack of little curly tails. The difficulty was clear. To be in disguise was different than mere pretending, for a disguise was intended to actually fool people. It had to be convincing, since they were, in fact, children. They would not be convincing as pigs, cows, chickens, and the like. Nor could they pass as grown-up humans, as they were simply not tall enough.
We must travel incognito, disguised as children, Alexander concluded.
Three children,
Cassiopeia agreed.
But which ones?
It was an interesting question. What trio, if they had known the word troika, they might have said, what troika of children could they possibly pretend to be? The troika of incorrigibles sat with furrowed brows, thinking.
I know,
Beowulf said. He jumped to his feet and clicked his heels together, then pretended to punch himself in the eye.
Do you mean the babushkawoos?
Alexander said, aghast.
The horrible babushkawoos?
Cassiopeia sounded intrigued. Beowulf shrugged.
Why not? We can be just as horrible as they are.
Alexander considered it.
No, he said. We could be more horrible.
We will be the most horrible there is,
crowed Cassiopeia.
And the wolfiest, too.
And there you have it. Superlatives in a nutshell. The woofiest and most horrible, incorrigible babushkawoos they would be. Speaking of masters of disguise and all things horrible, more horrible and most horrible, what was Lord Frederick's houseguest, the ailing and incognito Edward Ashton, up to during all this? The incorrigibles did not know the villain's whereabouts, but they rarely thought about it. Nor did Penelope know, but she thought of little else. That is the difference a few years' span in age can make. One day you see the world as a child does, largely oblivious to its dangers, the next, alas, you do not. Tempus fugit, indeed. But if you must know, and for you to know what Edward Ashton is up to when Penelope and the Incorrigibles do not, is a case of dramatic irony, if ever there was one. You may follow Agatha Swanburne's advice and simply see for yourself. For by now, the Master of Disguise has spent a few days recuperating in the Egyptian room, and is much recovered. In fact, he is well enough to pay a visit to the nursery at Ashton Place. The good news is that the Incorrigible children are not there, having just left for the bakehouse in their woofiest and most horrible disguises. But the bad news, woe and more woe. The bad news may prove to be very bad indeed.
Herring, herring and more herring.
Master Gogolev was quite renewed by the prospect of lunch, and the small round loaf he still carried in his pocket made the excitement nearly unbearable. He manoeuvred nimbly through the nursery door, with a large covered platter balanced on one hand like a professional waiter.
"Spin and spin, just like the old days,"
he crowed as he whirled into the room. In his youth, Gogolev had been a dancer until an injury ended his once promising career, or so he often claimed. In a grand gesture, he placed the tray on one of the children's desks and lifted the dome-shaped cover. He was far too preoccupied with himself and his herring to notice that his students were no longer in the nursery.
"Under no circumstances am I to be disturbed," he announced, "for I am hungry beyond endurance, and I require absolute silence to gain the full enjoyment of my meal."
"I shall do my best to oblige."
The curtains rustled, and the man who called himself Judge Quincy, you know the impostor's true identity, of course, stepped away from the window and into Gogolev's view. Gogolev was so startled, he nearly knocked over the tray. This made him doubly upset, for what a catastrophe that would have been.
"Who are you, sir, to impose upon my company in this manner? Did you come in the window like a burglar? Is it my bread you want, or my herring? I warn you, I shall defend myself and my lunch with vigor and no mercy."
Gogolev brandished the cover of the platter like a shield. The poor man had worked up quite a head of steam, but this is what comes of letting oneself get too hungry. Edward Ashton spoke sternly.
"Get hold of yourself, sir. That you fail to notice me is no fault of mine. I entered this room moments before you did, through the very same door, and was standing by the window the whole time. I am no burglar, but a friend of Lord Frederick Ashton's."
He stepped closer to the snivelling tutor.
"We have met before, in Brighton. Perhaps this will jog your memory. I am a man of the law."
Gogolev flinched.
"Man of the law? Met in Brighton? Are you Judge Quincy?" "Yes, of course you are. Forgive me, Your Honor. I meant no insult, I swear."
It should be noted that Master Gogolev had a terrible fear of the law due to a lost library book from childhood that weighed heavily on his conscience still. The mere sight of a police officer or a judge was enough to make him perspire with anxiety.
"But it is a strange coincidence to see you here at Ashton Place. The last time we met, you were a legal advisor to my former employers, the Babushkinovs."
His eye twitched as he said the name.
"I have many clients," Ashton replied smoothly. "Surely there is nothing strange about that. The simplest explanation is often the best, Master Gogolev. It is the lesson of Occam's razor. I would expect a professional educator to know that."
He made a circuit of the room, peeking into corners and behind the furniture.
Where are your students? That is who I have come to see. My students?
Gogolev had forgotten all about them. He glanced around the nursery and shrugged.
They were here a while ago. They must have gone to take their exercise out of doors.
Unsupervised!
Edward Ashton roared in anger.
The master of this house pays you to keep a close eye on his wards, you incompetent. Do you have any idea how much is at stake should they wander off?
He sniffed.
What's that I smell? Something burning? Something fishy?
Gogolev's fear of the law was great, but his selfish desire not to share his lunch was even greater. However, if you have ever tried to hide a large tray of smoked herring in a modest-sized room, you know the aroma is potent, no matter how quickly you slam down the lid you were previously using as a shield, nor how many cozy pillows embroidered with wise sayings you hurriedly pile on top.
No doubt it is my burning passion for poetry you smell,
Gogolev wheeled to face his interrogator.
And my fishing for a perfect turn of phrase, for I suffer from a broken heart and have spent hours in this very room writing verse as a balm for my pain.
He grabbed the sheaf of papers he had been working on earlier and shoved them into Edward Ashton's hands.
Here are my latest masterworks, though I fear they are too groundbreaking to find favor with the general public.
Is this yours, too?
Edward Ashton removed a small, hardcover book from within the pile of papers. It was bound in leather and much read from the look of it. The tutor grimaced.
Bah, no. It is some nonsense belonging to the children. A book of poetry translated from the German. Pure rubbish, in my opinion.
Wanderlust, said Ashton, turning the pages. I wander through the meadows green, made happy by the verdant scene. It seems a harmless little poem. What is your objection?
Gogolev seized the book back.
Harmless? Look at the cover. A collection of melancholy poetry. That is what the title promises. But made happy by the verdant scene? What kind of melancholy is that?
He flipped through the pages with mounting irritation.
It is the same all the way through. Charming descriptions of mountain goats and ibexes, blooming edelweiss and cute babies. This is not poetry. Where is the suffering, the torment, the thwarted dreams?
Edelweiss and babies. Fascinating.
Ashton's tone was quite changed.
You don't mind if I borrow this dreadful book, do you, my good man?
It was not Gogolev's book to lend, but the dark-eyed man of the law stood before him, expectant. Something snapped within the poor fellow. He turned pale and could not answer.
Master Gogolev, are you listening?
Edward Ashton stepped closer to the trembling tutor.
Give me the book, if you please.
He extended a hand slowly, like an accusing ghost. Gogolev stammered and swooned. The sight of a stern judge demanding a book from him had been the stuff of his nightmares since childhood. He rubbed his eyes, but the fearful apparition would not go away.
Am I dreaming, then? But the herring smelled so real.
In despair and confusion, he let the book slip through his hands.
Take it, spirit, take it, and be gone.
Ashton caught the volume neatly as Gogolev sank to the floor.
Thank you, my dear Master Gogolev.
He turned the book over in his hands and leafed through the first pages. Something he saw there made him catch his breath. Then he smiled.
Of course I did not find them in Switzerland, for they were not there,
he murmured.
Not in Switzerland at all.
But now, thanks to this idiot tutor and a book of mediocre poetry, He knew exactly where to look. He traced a finger along the book's cover, where the faded imprint of the author's name was pressed into the leather, though the gold leaf had long since worn away. Only a fool would leave such an obvious clue and sign her name so. But they were all fools, an optimistic, naive collection of fools bred from the foolish founder of the line. They must be culled like runts from a litter. This was how the Ashtons would survive. One more moon. It was enough time, but barely. He would need to leave England at once. Tomorrow he would book passage on a ship, any ship. This time he would not fail. But to Gogolev he only said,
"Mind your students, sir. Make sure they stay at Ashton Place. They must not run off. And keep this conversation to yourself. Tell no one I was here. Understood?"
Still cowering, Gogolev agreed to everything. If only he had never lost that library book in the first place. If only the herring were real. If only he could wake up from this awful dream. Alas and woe. If Miss Penelope Lumley had only known that her book of melancholy, German poetry in translation, was now in the clutches of Edward Ashton. You may imagine how she would feel about it, for this was the book of poetry Miss Mortimer had given her as a gift many years before. It had been Penelope's most treasured possession ever since, and when she was shipped off to Plinkst, she had left it with the incorrigible children as a keepsake of her affection. But Penelope did not know anything about this plot twist, at least not yet. She was still with her employers, who had long ago succumbed to that dreaded condition known as travel fatigue. After countless miles by troika and train, they were exhausted, queasy, and generally out of sorts. With the new clothes they could not afford now rumpled and covered with grit, the bedraggled Babushkinovs and their quiet but unusually alert governess arrived in St. Petersburg at last. St. Petersburg. Penelope struggled to hide her excitement. Like London, St. Petersburg was built along a central river called the Neva. Also like London, this sprawling city was both the nation's capital and the home of its royal rulers. In London, this was Queen Victoria. In St. Petersburg, it was Tsar Nicholas, a tall, stern military man with a fiery temper and an obsession for order. Nicholas was an autocrat, which means he was a sort of leader who tries to make his own people afraid of him. Under Nicholas's reign, the Russian national anthem was "God Save the Tsar," and the Russian national opera was "A Life for the Tsar," a patriotic, heroic, tragic opera. If any Russian bards had dared write a comedic operetta, it might well have been called The Tsar on Holiday. But comedic operettas were not a type of theatre one often saw in Russia, a fact that remains true to this very day. St. Petersburg, St. Petersburg. Captain Babushkinov haggled with the cab driver, who would take them from the train station to their lodgings. Penelope felt a pang to think she had arrived at the home of the Imperial Russian Ballet, yet would not have the chance to see them perform. It was a bitter disappointment. To save money, the captain had arranged for them to stay in military housing. Madame Babushkinov was furious to discover that their hotel was really a barracks, a single large hall with cots all in a row, and a washing-up room they would have to share. Luckily, the only other resident was a young artillery officer named Leo. He was visiting the capital while on leave, or so he modestly explained as he helped unload their luggage from the cab. He seemed a bookish sort of fellow, with a serious face and heavy straight eyebrows that sloped downward over his dark eyes. Penelope saw him several times in the common room of the barracks as she and the children explored their temporary quarters. On each occasion, he was either reading or scribbling in his diaries. Penelope and the Babushkinovs had no way of knowing this, but the thoughtful young man they were expected to share a bathroom with would prove to be one of the greatest novelists of all time. His name was Leo Tolstoy, and he would go on to write several literary masterpieces about war, peace, families both happy and unhappy, and other important topics that continue to fascinate readers to this very day. It was rare that women stayed in the barracks. A curtain was provided to hang like a screen to give some privacy to the cots assigned to Madame Babushkinov, Penelope, and Veronica. Young Tolstoy generously helped with this task, but showed no interest in befriending the captain to boast about his own exploits, or to gossip about wars and politics and career advancement, as one might expect of a junior officer. Instead, shortly after dinner, he approached Penelope in the common room and asked if he might sit quietly and observe the Babushkinov children. He told her that he had been thinking about the nature of childhood and planned to write about it, and wanted to better remember what being a child was like, as he was so nearly 24 and it already felt so very long ago. Gladly, she said yes, for she welcomed the company. Together they sat and watched Veronica, Boris and Konstantin at play.
"These children are horrible,"
Tolstoy shortly observed, thus displaying the deep insight into human nature that would characterize his later work. "They are," Penelope agreed. She felt immediately at ease with this young man, who seemed to possess a wisdom beyond his years. "The whole family is unhappy, for reasons too complicated to explain." She paused, but her instinct told her it was all right to confide in her new acquaintance. "I once had hope for these children, and tried to teach them as I was taught, but my efforts failed."
"No hopeless case is truly without hope," he said fervently. "What did you try to teach them?"
To be kind," she stammered. His directness took her by surprise, as did his unwitting use of the Swanburn motto. "To think of others as well as of oneself, to be grateful not just for good fortune, but for all fortune, the good and the bad. For it is life's nature to offer a bit of both, to use good manners, not just with one's friends, but with everyone. Even strangers."
"Do you mind if I take some notes?" he asked,
and removed a stubby pencil from his coat pocket. Penelope shook her head no, of course she would not mind.
"Please, go on," he urged.
She closed her eyes to better remember all she had learned at school, not only the capitals of nations and techniques of watercolor painting, but the truly important things. To spend time in nature, and not laze about indoors when the weather is fair, she said. To be curious about everything in the world and every person whom you meet. To be a loyal friend and avoid gossip. To always carry a book in case of missed omnibuses or long lines at the grocer's. For no moment spent reading can ever be thought wasted. To keep one's room tidy and strive for early bedtimes.
"And where did you learn all these wise things?" he inquired.
Penelope sat up straight and proud. "At the Swanburn Academy for Poor Bright Females, in Heathcote."
"Poor bright females." "Yes."
His eyebrows knitted together in an expression of profound concentration. Then he snapped his notebook shut and jumped to his feet.
"Some day I will start my own school for peasant children,"
he blurted, and took his leave abruptly, the way people do when they have had a marvellous idea and wish to think it through before it fades. Penelope did not mind. His intensity reminded her of Simon Harley Dickinson, and she took comfort in the thought that her new friend and Simon would get along swimmingly, if they should ever have the chance to meet. Whether the notion of a Tolstoy Academy for poor bright peasants was conceived at this very moment, we cannot know. But later in his life, Leo Tolstoy did in fact open a school for peasant children. He even wrote little primers designed to teach these children how to read. That he did all this while also penning some of the greatest novels ever written simply goes to show that those who do, do much. Those who talk, talk much. That is how Agatha Swanburne once put it anyway. In St. Petersburg, in April, the last light of dusk faded quite late in the evening, but for once the Babushkinovs chose an early bedtime, as they were exhausted. Being in the barracks put Madame on her best behavior, for she knew how important the charm of an officer's wife could be to securing his advancement. Yet, without the freedom to blame and criticize and order people around, she could find little to talk about. She soon crawled into her cot in silent irritation and turned to face the wall. The children were likewise worn out, and went to bed with only minor griping about the lumpy mattresses and thin, scratchy military blankets. Once tucked into her own narrow cot, Penelope fell asleep in an instant and dreamed she was back at Swanburn. But the illusion did not last, for the captain's rumbling snore from the other side of the curtain was a sound she would never have heard at school. Her bunkmate had snored with gusto, make no mistake. But Cecily's snores were of the piping soprano kind and blended nicely with the morning bird song. She awoke refreshed and quite early, in time to get the very first cup of tea from the samovar in the common room. She sat and sipped and considered her next move. The Babushkinovs will soon discover that the letter that brought them here was a fake, so I must act quickly, she thought. If I simply walk out, they will come looking for me. No, best to slip away under the pretext of some complicated errand. It will be hours before they realize I have not returned, and that will give me the advantage of a head start. All I need is a window of opportunity. A window of this kind is no ordinary hole in the wall. Such windows open, but briefly and only once. To dither and dally when the window of opportunity opens means to end up with one's nose pressed against the glass of fate, gazing with regret at what might have been. There is an old saying that advises us to look before you leap. But to leap without looking is not nearly as bad as to look and look again and never work up the courage to leap at all. By the time Penelope returned, Veronica had arisen in a deep crisis of confidence. She claimed to have forgotten not only how to dance, but how to walk. Paralyzed with fright, she lay face down on her cot, moaning into the pillow. Madame Babushkinov was ill-equipped to console the child, for she was a bundle of nerves herself and chattered non-stop. "I am done wasting away in Plinkst, that is for certain," she announced. "This is where I belong. The culture, the excitement. Listen to me, Ivan. Once our Nikki is in the ballet, I shall have to stay in St. Petersburg to supervise her. A girl of her age needs a mother. We will lease an apartment here, in the city. Wouldn't you like that, precious girl?" Veronica raised her tear-streaked face from the pillow. "Only if the savages stay home," she said heatedly. "Boris and Konstantin can live in Plinkst. If they come here, it will ruin everything." The captain put down his newspaper.
"An apartment in St. Petersburg," he said to his wife, incredulous. "You will spend me into bankruptcy."
"We want to go home,"
the boys wailed, for this idea of their mother abandoning the family to live with Veronica did not sit well with them.
"Fine, fine," the captain retorted. "We shall all go home at once."
Madame snatched his newspaper away and scolded.
"Ivan Viktorovich, stop tormenting the children!"
as Veronica shrieked wildly into her pillow.
"We want to walk outside and throw stones in the river,"
the boys demanded. This was the most sensible thing any of them had said so far. Penelope quickly volunteered to take them, for she was desperate to get away from the quarreling. Her window of opportunity to escape had not yet opened, but in the meanwhile, she could at least take a walk and see her surroundings, for she was in St. Petersburg, home of the Imperial Ballet and countless other wonders, and who knew if she would ever pass this way again? Boris and Konstantin were smugly victorious about having an excursion while their sister was left behind. They spent the first quarter hour of their walk gloating. Then they began planning the lies they would tell Veronica upon their return, about all the wonderful adventures she had missed.
"We'll say we saw an organ grinder with a monkey," suggested Boris. "And a fire eater," said Konstantin. "A fire-eating monkey who does tricks while riding a horse. No, a camel. Camels stink. A horse is better." "Idiot, you have never been near a camel. How do you know what they smell like? I know they smell almost as bad as you." "As you, you mean?"
And so on. Penelope listened but did not interfere. They were horrible boys from a horrible family, and they had no wish to change. Trying to stop them from being cruel was like trying to stop the tides. They walked along the granite embankments of the Neva, past the magnificent Admiralty building and its proud white columns, its countless statues and friezes depicting figures from myths and ancient times. "There are the four seasons," she showed the twins as they walked, "and the four elements, and the four winds. There is the goddess, Isis, and the Roman god of the sea, Neptune." By now they had reached the central gate. "Look up," she said, pointing at the tower. "All the way up, at the top of the golden spire. There is a weather vane there, in the form of a ship. It is molded after one of Peter the Great's actual ships." Penelope knew all this from her Swanburn geography class. "The weather vane has a name. Karablik."
"That means little ship," Boris said, grudgingly showing interest.
His brother refused to look up. "Indeed it does," Penelope said. "Imagine, a little three-masted schooner made of gold sailing across the sky."
"Weather vanes don't have names," Konstantin said, kicking at the ground.
"This one does." Penelope gazed up at it, awestruck. She wished she had Alexander Incorrigible's spyglass, so she might get a better view.
"Ships don't sail in the sky," Boris pointed out.
"This one does," she repeated. She had to shield her eyes from the harsh gleam of sun along the spire's golden edge. It was like the needle of a compass pointing at the heavens. The shining Karablik danced on top. Now, Penelope knew good architecture when she saw it. She had been to Buckingham Palace, and the British Museum, and Ashton Place was nothing to sneeze at either. But there was something so brave and solitary about this little ship of gold weaving its way through the air currents. Never had she seen anything so exquisite.
"I'd knock down that golden spire and melt it. Then we'd be rich," Konstantin said.
As if in protest, the Karablik gave a half spin in a sudden gust, then righted itself. What a highly unusual weather vane. It seemed to whisper words that only Penelope could hear. "Be brave, for you too will weather what is to come, and right yourself somehow, whichever way the wind blows." She watched the Karablik dance and let its message console her and fill her heart with joy. How full of the unexpected life repeatedly proved to be. Only 3 years had passed since she was a schoolgirl in geography class at Swanburn, doodling funny pictures in the margins of Cecily's notebook. "Cecily the Great," she had scrawled beneath a drawing of Peter the Great, to which she had added freckles and two long pigtails. Who could have foretold that she would set foot in the city he founded, even if only for a day? All those unhappy days and nights in Plinks might have dimmed her Swanburnian spirit temporarily, but this new feeling within, this swelling gratitude and simple delight, it was something more than optimism. It was more, even, than optimuchism. She suspected that Tolstoy fellow would understand right away. It was the true, clear knowledge that no matter what might happen later, for this single hour, her eyes were wide open to the splendor of it all. The golden spire against a crisp blue sky and the mirrored surface of the winding Neva reflecting them both. An even more perfect version of this already glorious world. And all the while, scampering in circles around her, poking each other out of boredom and meanness, the two horrible children who could not stop tormenting each other long enough to see the beauty of any of it. foolish twins. But they had no model to learn from save the pettiness of their parents, whose heads were too full of worries about money and rank and the opinions of others to appreciate the riches they already had. A family, whole and healthy, and all living under the same roof. Imagine how glad the long-lost Lumleys might be to possess such a treasure. It was a great luxury to be unhappy about small things, Penelope realized. All the petty complaints and discomforts of everyday life meant nothing compared to those sudden, unlucky swoops of fate that arrive with no warning, like a hawk that dives from a dizzying height to snatch an unsuspecting rabbit from the ground. The boys were restless. They raced ahead, turned corners, and paid no attention to where they were going. Penelope followed, but the side streets were narrow and full of shadows. It would be too easy to get lost. "We have wandered too far from the main road," she said once she caught up with them. "We must retrace our steps." The twins took this literally and walked backward, exchanging quick punches every time they bumped into each other. Soon they reached the Neva once more and scoured the banks for rocks to skip along the water. Penelope watched as they fought over who saw which rock first and whose rock had skipped farthest and which of them would be first to touch the opposite bank in a swimming contest. And she wondered, could the Babushkinovs ever retrace their steps to a day when they were not so miserable and chart a different course forward? "At least the Ashtons have a curse to blame for their troubles," she thought. "If not for the terrible shipwreck that landed Admiral Percival Rancine Ashton and his crew on an unmapped island, and if not for the Admiral's selfish desire for a new fur-lined vest, which made him cruelly hunt the litter of wolf cubs whose mother was the sacred animal of the tribe, and who laid her terrible wolf curse upon him and his descendants, causing all sorts of difficulty and bother, until now there are only a few weeks left for me to get home and sort things out. Why, if not for all that, the Ashtons might have been the happiest family in England." She gazed across the water. Of course, if not for the storm at sea, the shipwreck would never have happened in the first place. But one cannot blame the sea for what happens on dry land. Listen to me, inventing such sayings. I suppose I must have the blood of Agatha Swanburn in my veins after all. The twins had grown bored once more. Now they wanted to go back and torment their sister. To return to the barracks, they had to cross Nevsky Prospect, the city's main boulevard that either began or ended at the Admiralty, depending on which way you were facing. The Admiralty was the headquarters of the Russian Navy, and all along Nevsky Prospect were sailors in uniform. Naturally, this made Penelope think of Simon, who had spent a fair amount of time at sea himself. Simon. Simon Harley Dickinson. Repeating his name was like reciting a very short, very cheering poem. Simon was the best navigator she knew. Give him a sextant and a glimpse of the stars, and there was no chance of getting lost. Yet she was the one who had to find her way back home this time, and on her own, too. As they walked, she kept glancing over her shoulder at the golden spire of the Admiralty. The Karablik caught the light, winking with each change of the breeze. Block after block they travelled, but the brave little ship stayed in view the whole time, just as the moon does. If only she could sail that glittering golden ship across the sky, all the way home to Ashton Place. The seventh chapter. A new baby nurse is hired. Simon, Simon Harley Dickinson, with that unruly, poetical forelock and the gleam of genius in his eye. Now perhaps you too are wondering if we will ever see Simon Harley Dickinson again. He had always been a difficult fellow to pin down, with his love of adventure and the wide open seas, his endless search for a fresh plot twist, his yearning to explore parts unknown, with only his sextant and the North Star to guide him. Whether the job was to jump on a stolen velocipede, win over a band of pirates, Visible eyes, invisible ink, pen a sonnet, or don a disguise, Simon Harley Dickinson was the man for it. But he had no fixed address, which made him, if not long lost, at least easily misplaced. The incorrigibles could not help but think about him as they fashioned their disguises, for Simon was a man of the theatre, skilled